Good morning. It is Kale and Company live here on WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com. Great to have you with us on this Tuesday morning. And as always, we are presented by Northeast Delta Dental. Northeast Delta Dental has individual and family plans designed to fit your lifestyle. Learn more and find your plan at DeltaDentalCoversMe.com. And joining me on this portion of the show is Eliza Fisher. Eliza, good morning to you.
Good morning, Ken. How are you?
I'm doing great. Eliza has, along with her dad, made me aware of the Miss New Hampshire Volunteer organization. So we welcome you to the show, Eliza. And in September of 2023, you were crowned Miss New Hampshire Volunteer 2024. So congratulations to you.
Thank you very much.
How did it all come about?
So I have been competing in different pageant organizations for years, and you're always looking for where you're going to grow the best and where you're going to gain the most from. So I found that in the Miss Volunteer America organization. So I started competing last year, and then I won this title in September, and it's been an amazing ride ever since.
I'll bet it has, and you'll be representing New Hampshire this June, correct, at the Miss Volunteer America competition in Jackson, Tennessee.
I will. This will be my fourth time ever going to Jackson, Tennessee. I went for the teen competition last year as well as the Miss Candidates competition. And then I went, and we have a teen here from New Hampshire, Miss New Hampshire Teen Volunteer Rachel Brown. She competed just a few weeks ago, so I was there to support her for that as well.
Well, that is terrific. So tell us about your reign as Miss New Hampshire Volunteer and what you've been doing since you were crowned. And by the way, we have the crown in the studio, and we're going to have you wear it so that we can get a picture of it and put it on our website afterwards. But you have your crown here in the studio. So since being crowned, what have been your duties and your responsibilities as Miss New Hampshire Volunteer?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a lot expected of me this year. So the Miss Volunteer America organization is only 3 years old. So there's a lot of footwork and heavy lifting that I have to do to really get this program off the ground in the state of New Hampshire. If you travel across the country, it's already pretty big in other states. They have dozens of women competing for the title each year. And here in New Hampshire, we don't quite have those numbers yet. So it's my job this year to be able to promote the organization and get not only candidates involved, young women involved, but also volunteers and sponsorships and whatnot. So there's a lot that's on my plate this year. It's nothing that I can't handle. But, you know, it's getting out into the community as often as I can, doing TV shows and radio shows. So my past few months have just been filled with events like that.
So what do your credentials have to be in order to, be considered for Miss New Hampshire Volunteer? I mean, is there a certain amount of volunteer work that you've had to do in the past in order to qualify? How does it all work?
So there's no set amount of volunteer hours, and that's a really great question. When you go into that interview on your competition day, they want to see that you are going to be the person that gets out and makes a change in volunteers in your community. So that's really important. So if you're already getting out and doing that, then you have a little bit more to talk about,
sure,
which is very helpful.
Yeah.
What you do have to do to be able to compete, if you're competing in the teen organization, you have to be between the ages of 13 and 17. Mm-hmm. And for the Miss candidates, it's 18 and 26. Teen candidates have to be currently in high school. And Miss candidates have to have a high school diploma and be actively working or actively in school or both. So that's what is expected of the young women that are competing, that they're going to get out and make a change in that they are pursuing greater education.
I had an opportunity to see the organizations that you have volunteered with, and it's a very impressive list. How did it all your volunteering get started?
So when I was 12 years old, I lost a close friend of mine to her two-year battle with brain cancer. So I saw firsthand not only the struggles that she went through, but more significantly, you see the emotional and financial toll that it takes on a family as well. 2 months later, I think it's important to add that another family in the community very suddenly lost their daughter to brain cancer as well. So the same exact thing. Brain cancer specifically is the most deadly cancer among children, and with that, it's the second most diagnosed cancer among children. So I saw that need, and that's when I started working with the Children's Hospital at Dartmouth here in New Hampshire to support families any way that I could, whether it be emotionally or financially. That then grew into a partnership with David's House, which is located on the same property as the Children's Hospital at Dartmouth. And it works the same way the Ronald McDonald House does, and it provides a nice home for families when their child is receiving care at CHAD. Then that grew into a partnership with Boston Children's Hospital, and now being part of Miss Volunteer America, we have a national partnership with St. Jude. So it was all meant to be for me to be a part of this program because I've done a lot of work with them now as well.
Wow, that is a very impressive resume. And again, you started at the age of 12, very young, volunteering. And we need more volunteers, wouldn't you agree?
We absolutely do. I do a lot of volunteering events, some in Crown and Sash, some not. The one thing that I always get in the emails when I sign up to volunteer or while I'm there is just the staff of each charitable organization, and they all desperately need more volunteers and more people to get out and get involved in their community. That's for sure.
How do people learn about volunteer opportunities? Are they posted anywhere? Is it just a matter of inquiring? How did it work for you?
It's a little bit of both. That's a very good question. I think it's my job as Miss New Hampshire Volunteer to definitely be letting people know of the volunteer opportunities that they can have. But as for myself, I stay on email lists with the organizations that mean the most to me, so that I get their inquiry as soon as they need anybody. You can follow organizations on social media too. Mm-hmm. They always post when they need it, and it doesn't take that much work to find the people who need help. You just have to look out for yourself.
Yeah, I would guess that would be the case. So is part of your mission as Miss New Hampshire a volunteer to make perhaps better access to volunteer opportunities?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's another way that the organization can grow, too. The more that people look to you as a resource, the more the word is going to spread about what it is that you're doing.
And you have, detailed your volunteer career to date anyway, and yours is mostly with medical organizations, if not all, but there are many, many ways to volunteer, and many organizations are looking for volunteers in all walks of life.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, and I think it's just a matter of people pursuing them. And as you say, now that we have access to social media, probably it's a lot easier than it was in the past to find out about these openings.
That has to be the most helpful tool, for sure. And quite honestly, if we're all going to be blunt, we're spending a lot of our time on there anyway.
Right. So probably too much.
Probably.
Yeah. But at any rate, you've been able to find out about them. And in your case, did like one lead to another, or how did it work?
They all do.
Completely separate?
They all do. Once you get involved with one event, you almost get the itch for it.
Yeah.
And you start looking for more opportunities. You have people that see you at events that hand you their business card, and ask you to reach out to them so that you can get involved as well.
So in order to compete in the competition, Miss New Hampshire Volunteer, we'll talk about the qualifications, other than the volunteerism that you need to compete for Miss New Hampshire Volunteer. We'll do that after the break. Eliza Fisher is with us, and she is the reigning Miss New Hampshire Volunteer for 2024. And she is going to don her tiara in the not-too-distant future. We'll get a picture of that from her dad and post it on social media. And we will continue right here on Kale & Company, WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com, presented by Northeast Delta Dental. And we'll be right back. Welcome back. It is Kale & Company Live right here on WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com. A delight to have you with us, but even more of a delight to have Eliza Fisher in studio, Miss New Hampshire Volunteer 2024. So just before the break, we talked about qualifications. Other than volunteerism, what are the qualifications that they're looking for someone to hold the title of Miss New Hampshire Volunteer?
Yeah, they're looking for really well-rounded women that are going to stand out in a crowd but then have something to say once they have a seat at the table. So to compete, you have to have a talent that could be, and I've seen a lot at this point, you could be rollerblading across the stage, or you could be tap dancing like myself, or singing, or jump roping, or there was a hula hoop routine at our state pageant.
Really? Yeah.
Yep. It was very interesting, very cool. So you have to have a talent. You have to have your interview prepared. They can ask you anything, so they're just looking for quick, witty, well-spoken young women. And then there's a gown and swimsuit portion for the Miss. For teen, they do not have swimsuit. They have a fitness portion instead.
Mm-hmm. And so you're a tap dancer.
I am.
Wow.
Yep. Since the age of two.
Since the age of two, you've been tapping, huh?
Yes.
Wow. That is really something.
And I teach now.
You teach tap?
Yes, I do.
Oh, I know a prospective student I could probably send in your direction.
Yep.
It's not me, but it's a good friend of mine who has been thinking about taking tap dancing lessons for any number of years now and has never done it. But knowing that she might be able to have a teacher like you, it could be a different situation.
I enjoy it.
Yeah.
I have one adult tap class, and that's actually my best friend I met while teaching that class. So,
oh, really?
Yep. Yeah. I love the adult class.
Now, what do the adults range from age-wise?
Mostly 30s right now.
30s, yeah.
So, yep.
Well,
it's not bad.
Maybe in the future you'll have someone just a little bit older than that.
That would be all right with me.
All right. How often do you do it?
I teach one night a week.
One night a week,
from about 4 p.m. to 9 p.m.
Yeah.
So.
Very good.
Yep.
So, and what else do you do in your working life?
Yep. So, like I said earlier, it's required of me to either be in school right now or be working full-time. So I'm doing both. I work full-time in a chiropractic office here in Concord called Wellness All Chiropractic, and I am the executive wellness assistant, executive wellness coordinator there, which is office management. And then I teach dance, and in the summer, I forgot to tell you this earlier, I work at Chuckster's as well.
At Chuckster's? Oh, the movie theater, yeah?
Yeah. The Family Fun Park.
Oh, the Fun Park. Oh, yes. Yeah, I was thinking of another. Yeah,
Mini
the Family
golf
Fun Park. Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, even
so
better.
So that's fun. And then I'm in school full-time online to become a certified health coach.
Ah.
So, yep.
Very good. Well,
busy.
You do keep busy, and you have to prepare for the competition as well.
Yes, I do.
So what is the interview process like when you compete for this, you know, not only on a local, but now on a national level?
So it's very different than your typical job interview. And what I've found in my real life is it almost makes job interviews about 10 times easier.
Oh, really?
So yeah. There is a very high expectation when you walk into your interview, and you're usually standing at a podium in front of a panel of sitting judges, and it's timed. So when I go into my interview in Jackson, Tennessee, I will stand behind a podium, and it'll be more of a question and answer scenario, but what I'm always focused on is making it feel more of like a conversation for the judges, mm-hmm. because they're usually just as nervous as the girls competing. So just making them feel more comfortable and letting them know that I'm a real person as well is really important to me. So I'll have 8.5 minutes of that question and answer back and forth, and then I'll have 1.5 minutes for a prepared closing statement. So I'm working on that right now.
So it's somewhat like, or quite a bit like, I guess, the Miss America pageant that people are familiar with, but Miss Volunteer USA, is that what it's called?
Miss Volunteer America.
America,
yep.
Okay.
Yep. So it's a bit of, if you want to understand it a little bit better, it's a bit of a mix between Miss America and Miss USA. Miss USA is looking for that model to stand out and also be a role model. Miss America is looking for somebody who... It's become a little bit more of just an interview competition and just a speaking competition. So they've changed over the years. So this is looking for somebody who is going to stand out but is going to make a difference as well and represent the program to the best of their ability.
Now, since being crowned Miss New Hampshire volunteer, what are some of the activities you've been involved in terms of getting out and speaking to groups and organizations? And I understand most recently walking in the St. Patrick's Day parade in downtown Manchester.
Yes, that's fun. I always enjoy when you think of Miss New Hampshire volunteer in a parade, you're thinking she's going to sit in a convertible and wave. And I have definitely done that before. I prefer walking. I get to go along the parade route and high five little kids and give hugs and meet people and take pictures along the way. So I feel like I get out and I make those branches in my community a little bit more by doing that. I went down to Boston in late September, and I walked volunteered beforehand in the St. Jude Walk Run. Mm-hmm. I've been on outside TV. I visited, just senior living facilities. Mm-hmm. Not only in the remote area, you have to create your brand across the state. So did that in the North Country as well. So it's a bunch of little things that all add up together.
And it's all in an effort to create awareness of not only the competition, but the fact that volunteers are very much needed in all kinds of activities, all kinds of organizations.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So do you think you've made an impact since you've been crowned Miss New Hampshire Volunteer?
I do believe that I've made an impact. I've been in... there's a pretty strong pageant community in New Hampshire, which most people don't know about. If you go to a state like Alabama, mm-hmm. these young girls are competing from the age of 2 to the time they're 28 in any program that they can. And here in New Hampshire, we don't have that many options for programs. So you know a lot of the people that you're competing with, and a lot of the people compete in the same programs for a long time. So the one thing that I'm trying to encourage as a title holder is using the connections that I have in our pageant community here in New Hampshire, and encouraging people that you don't need to keep trying for the same program year after year after year, mm-hmm. and dragging yourself out. There might be a program out there that's better for you. And I found that my connection was the strongest with Miss Volunteer America, which I'm very grateful for. I didn't stick with the same thing year after year after year to just keep getting let down. So that's another goal of mine when promoting for the program and trying to recruit women for the program, that what they're most comfortable with right now might not be what's best suiting them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of a culture change that I'm trying to make in New Hampshire.
Sure.
And that's not always the easiest. That's
right.
Probably going to be my hardest job this year.
So what if young women like yourself want more information about how to get involved with this pageant?
Yeah, so they can always reach out to our social media platforms. We're very quick with getting back to people. So I'm Miss NH Vol, V-O-L, on Instagram, and I run that solely, so
okay.
I'm pretty quick about that. Myself and my directors for the organization run the Facebook account, which is Miss New Hampshire Volunteer. It's very easy to find. We have an email that people can reach out to as well, but the social media is probably where they're going to get the quickest response.
So Eliza Fisher is currently Miss New Hampshire Volunteer and will soon be competing for Miss Volunteer America, which sounds great.
Thank you. I'm very excited.
And when is the competition?
The competition, I arrived June 15th, and the final night is June 22nd, and it will be broadcast on pageantslive.com.
Pageantslive.com. Well, Eliza Fisher, it was a delight to meet you and your dad here
Thank
today.
You.
And we wish you all the best and stay in touch. Maybe we'll get you back on again prior to the competition.
Thank you very much. I appreciate this greatly.
Well, we appreciate you coming in, and we'll put a picture up of you and your tiara on our social media pages. So thanks so much, Eliza, and continued success. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Ken.
We'll be back after these words. Kale & Company Live, WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com, presented by Northeast Delta Dental. We'll be right back. We welcome you back. It's Kale & Company Live here on WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com. Great to have you with us on this Tuesday morning. And it is time for our monthly visit with the New Hampshire Department of Safety. And joining us is Amy McLaughlin. Amy, welcome. Great to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Ken. We really appreciate you having us.
Well, it is our pleasure entirely. And Amy is the Community Risk Reduction Specialist and Public Information Officer from the New Hampshire Division of Fire Safety Office of the State Fire Marshal. That's a mouthful, Amy. But thanks for being with us. And what does the Community Risk Reduction Specialist do?
So it sounds way more fancy than it probably is. One of our roles, I guess we have a couple of roles here in general at the Fire Marshal's Office, and it's really to prevent fires from happening, investigate when they do happen. And we do that through three different ways. We have a Bureau of Education and Outreach, which is what I do. We have a Safety and Construction, and we have our investigations, and they go to the fatal fires, if there's a carbon monoxide death, things of that nature. So what we do is really look to identify the risks. We have all the fire departments in the state.
Mm-hmm.
They report in on the different types of calls that they go to. And they do this annually. So we have a lot of data, which doesn't sound very exciting. But what it does do is it allows us to look at, you know, what's the fire problem in New Hampshire? What kind of calls are they going on? Then we can kind of help to assess, you know, what those risks are.
Mm-hmm.
And develop our educational programs around those risks, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. And it seems like fire departments are certainly, you know, certainly work together. You often see when there's a, you know, a major fire in one community, there'll be fire departments respond from several communities to in an attempt to, you know, douse the blaze and get it under control. And it seems to be a very collaborative effort between the fire departments in this state.
Yeah, it definitely is. I mean, there are a lot of mutual aid agreements that the fire departments do have amongst themselves. There's a lot of there's definitely a lot of work together.
So let's just say hypothetically, because I'm sure a lot of the audience and myself included doesn't know how this works. If there's a major fire, let's pick out Hooksett, for example. Are there certain towns that are assigned to help Hooksett if they, you know, have a major fire? Or is that something that happens, you know, on the spur of the moment, you know, after the fire breaks out?
So that's definitely on the response side. And I'm not as familiar with exactly how each town decides who it is that responds. That tends to be the surrounding towns, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
We work mainly on the prevention side.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We do a lot with the engineering. So let's say somebody goes to any place in New Hampshire that has a state-owned building,
right,
whether it's a healthcare facility, whether they're going to college at one of the university system colleges, or they're going to a state park that has any kind of a building.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we've been involved with helping to make sure that those buildings are all up to fire code. If there's been a change in the construction, we work with them collaboratively. So they say, oh, hey, we would like to do this because we want to be able to serve our customers or our students or our patients better. And we have the state fire code, so they'll show us their plans, and then we would help to facilitate that and work with them to make sure that they have the fire protection in place to make that happen. So we're more on the, and then if at a residential home, if there's a fire and there's a fatality, we are called in to investigate those to find out what the origin and the cause is. And we kind of tailor some education where we know some of the risk factors, like being an older adult is a risk factor. They sometimes have a harder time getting out. Cooking safety, cooking fires, that's definitely a risk. So we'll go in and we'll do some investigation there. So we're not really on the response side quite so much.
Well, that being said, what you do is very important. And what you know, are your efforts in an attempt to educate the public about fire safety topics?
Sure. So one really important thing that people can do in their homes is they can close the door. And it's a little bit counterintuitive because you think you want to get out. And that's the first message we give, is to get out and stay out. You want to know two ways out of your home, have practice an escape plan. But if you can't, if it happens too quickly and suddenly you find yourself in your home and you can't get out, you want to close the door to wherever you are. You want to try and put like a blanket, if you have anything, underneath the door. That's going to keep you safer and give the first responders time to get there. What it'll do is, we know that if the door is open, that room can get to be over 1,000 degrees.
Mm. Wow.
Nobody can survive that.
Right.
They can survive 100 plus degrees. It's not comfortable. It won't be great. But closing that door, if they can't get out, is going to potentially save their life. It gives the first responders more time to get there.
So if you can't possibly get out of your home or your apartment, whatever it may be, the best thing to do is close that door, put a little blanket under the opening at the bottom of the door, and try to close it off that way.
Yeah, for sure. And even before that, hopefully you're not going to get trapped there.
Yeah,
you're going to have a smoke alarm.
Right.
You're going to have a carbon monoxide alarm, because those are what are really going to give you the time to get out. And you might only have 2 or 3 minutes.
Mm, yeah. And those are very important. I mean, I know that you know, in apartments, they're checked on a semi-regular basis that everything is up to code. The batteries are working. The smoke detectors are working, and that the fire alarms in the building are working as well. So I think in an apartment, the maintenance crew checks regularly if you're up to code and up to speed. But what about an individual home, just a regular home in the Concord area, Manchester area, whatever it might be? People can get a little lax about their smoke detectors, I would have to think.
Sure.
If they have to do it completely on their own.
100%. We like people to try and think about doing that at least 2 times a year. We prefer monthly.
Yeah.
But even if they can think of it when you daylight savings time, we just had it. You know, we say check your clock, check your smoke alarm.
Right.
And we used to say check your batteries, but a lot of them have 10-year batteries now, mm-hmm. so they don't even have to do it all the time. They don't have to change the batteries all the time. They can put it up and they're fine if they test it and make sure that it does work. So they want to have their smoke alarms in every bedroom. They want to have it outside of each of sleeping area. And then they want to have one on every level of the home, including the basement. And if they do have a finished attic, that would be a great space to have it as well. Preferably interconnected so that if one sounds, you'll hear it throughout your house.
So we're talking about, upwards of what maybe 8, 10 smoke detectors potentially in a home.
Potentially.
Depending on the size of the home, obviously, and the bedrooms involved, and the attic space, and the basement, and what have you. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, I have to ask you this question, because back in the old days, you know, when I was growing up as a kid, everybody smoked in their home. Or not everybody, but a lot of people smoked in their homes. Is that dwindling these days? I would have to think so, that there is not as much of that going on as there once was. Is that true or not?
So it's interesting. We're finding that the incidence of smokers is a little bit less when it comes to cigarette smoking.
Mm-hmm.
Fewer, but the cost is higher. I think it used to be, if there was a smoking cigarette fire, it was like $3,000, but now it can cost like $18,000. And they tend to be more dangerous in nature as well.
Yeah.
So fewer smokers, a bit more dangerous.
Bit more dangerous, yeah. Well, we're talking with Amy McLaughlin, and Amy is the Community Risk Reduction Specialist and Public Information Officer with the New Hampshire State Fire Marshal's Office. And we will talk more about fire prevention and detection coming up after these words. It's Kale and Company Live and our monthly visit with the New Hampshire Department of Safety, which has a number of divisions that we love to chat with. We'll be back with more after these words on WKXL and HTalkRadio.com, presented by Northeast Delta Dental, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. Kale and Company Live here on WKXL and HTalkRadio.com. Our guest this morning is Amy McLaughlin, Community Risk Reduction Specialist and Public Information Officer at the New Hampshire Division of Fire Safety Office of the State Fire Marshal. And we are talking fire safety today. The cookout season is coming up. People will, and I know there are people that cook, outdoors all year long, but most do it primarily in the warmer months of the year. So we're getting toward cookout season, cooking out on the grill. And how far should those grills be away from the home before you ignite them?
So they need to be, at the very least, 10 feet away.
10 feet.
I believe that's the current code. Yes, it is. So that'll depend, though, too. So every local town needs to have, they need to follow the state fire code, right? They can also have more strict ordinances or rules in their particular town.
Mm-hmm.
And then it also depends on if they have an HOA, a homeowners association.
Okay.
If they live in a condo.
Yeah.
If you have a porch, they may very well not allow it.
Right.
It's not allowed really at all sometimes to have a grill or a propane tank or anything. Sometimes it's even on your property if you live in a condo and such. So
right.
you want to make sure if it's a single family residence, it's at least 10 feet, depending on whether there's a local code in place that says otherwise.
But it would be at least 10 feet.
But that would be your best practice, at least 10 feet.
Yeah.
Yes.
Away from the house before you ignite the grill, whether it be a charcoal grill or a propane grill, whatever it might be, it's got to be 10 feet away from the house. So bear that in mind. So you often hear of incidents or accidents involving propane tanks. What are some of the things people should think about when using propane?
So you really want to just... So when it comes to fire, right?
Yeah.
It's a chemical reaction, and it needs a couple of things. It needs heat, and it needs fuel. Those are two of the things that it needs. So you really want to be thinking about that. You want to think about keeping those things separate, just as a general rule of thumb.
Mm-hmm.
So some fuel examples might be flammable liquids. You might have plastic, foam, paper, wood, oil, anything like that. That's going to be your fuel. Then you're going to have heat sources. You've got open flames. Inside it might be a pilot light. You might have engines, small engines. You want to basically keep those separate. So you want to keep your heat and your fuel away from each other.
Mm-hmm.
So when it comes to propane and such, you want to make sure that you're just very careful. You follow the instructions that are on the, on the unit that you have, and make sure that you understand what you're doing with it.
Yeah, no, absolutely so. Now, you do see some people, especially during the winter months, grilling inside their garages. You see that once in a while. That is not recommended, is it?
It's not recommended because not only is it a fire hazard, that's when we start thinking about carbon monoxide.
Hmm.
Anytime you have something that burns fuel, be it a fossil fuel, you have the risk of carbon monoxide poisoning. And it can build up very quickly, especially the less ventilation you have, the less airflow you have, the more dangerous it is and more quickly dangerous it is. So you definitely do not want to grill inside your garage, please.
So any dangers we should be aware of when it comes to our charcoal cooking out of doors?
I'm just going to say make sure that anything fuel related isn't near your charcoal. You want to make sure that your matches are separated. You want to make sure that you don't have anything that can catch fire really quickly. A good rule of thumb is that nothing should be closer than 3 feet.
Okay.
That's kind of a nice safe distance that we like to recommend, whether it's indoor on the stove, inside, or it's outside. 3 feet is kind of a nice little safety zone, mm-hmm. little safety net.
And so another factor is you have to be attentive. Don't leave the grill, don't leave the stove unattended, because you just never know what might happen.
So I'll throw a little statistic at you just because one of the things that we do, we look at numbers.
Yeah.
So there are roughly 400-ish cooking fires a year on average, over the last couple of years. And at least a third of those have been from unattended cooking. And that just means people are multitasking. They're trying to do a thousand different things.
Sure.
So we recommend that they set a timer just to remind themselves that they're cooking, because if they walk away to do something else. There are a few other things that we like for people to do while they are cooking. I'd love to give those tips if it's okay.
Oh, absolutely.
Thank you. So we like them to keep an eye on what they're doing, set that timer, to turn pot handles toward the back of the stove, and to keep a lid nearby when cooking. So if a small grease fire starts, they can slide a lid right over the pan. We don't want them to put water on it. We just want them to slide the lid over. And then to really have that safe zone of about 3 feet. Mm-hmm. If you've got really little, young children, or you've got pets in the home, we really recommend that 3 feet or so. And just to really make sure that you have your working smoke alarm as well, right placed where it should be.
Yeah, absolutely. So what if you're in the unfortunate circumstance of having perhaps walked away from the stove and a grease fire, you see flames emerging, you know, from the stove, the top of the stove. The immediate reaction, I don't know, people I've heard, I don't know if this is an old wives' tale or whatever, but they say, you know, throw flour on it. I've heard that before. You know, some people might react and throw water at it. You know, who knows? What would be the best way to react if you see flames, you know, coming up from your stove?
So the best way to react is to, hopefully, you have a pot lid. A pot lid can be your best friend, as can a cookie sheet, something like that, to put right over it.
Really? Yeah.
That's your best friend.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's really what we would recommend. If you know how to use a fire extinguisher already, you can certainly, if it's really small and you know what you're doing, but that is not the time to get out your fire extinguisher. Look at it, start to read the instructions, right. Try and figure out what to do with the pin, because chances are it's going to happen more, it's going to grow more quickly than you can safely put that out. So we do not recommend actually using a fire extinguisher unless you really truly know what you're doing.
Right.
And otherwise, it's the recommendation to get out and stay out and call 911.
And, of course, you might not have access to one immediately in your kitchen. Maybe you should, but I'm sure most people don't. I guess one of the things would be to turn off the burner. You know, that would be one thing, right, that you could do.
Ken, I'm so glad you said that, because as soon as I finished talking, I was like, Amy, you should have said to turn off the supply. So thank you.
Yeah.
Appreciate that.
So, yeah, turn off the burner. Because I say this from personal experience, because it's happened to me. And you know, you just don't know what, you know, you kind of freeze for a second.
That's exactly what
and
you
should
do. And
I said, well, you know, the best thing to do would be to shut off the burner, first of all. But it has happened, and I'm sure it's happened to a lot of people. If they, you know, if they take their eye off it for the shortest amount of time, even. But don't throw flour on it. Now that's is that an old wives' tale? Or I didn't do that.
So I'll tell you what, Ken. That's not in our official messaging, and I've never heard that particular one.
Okay.
But I am going to look it up.
Okay.
As soon as we get off the phone, I am going to look up.
I've heard that.
I have not.
But at any rate, just, you know, turn the burner off. I don't know. If you throw water at it, I don't know.
You do not want to throw water at it.
No,
that's no good.
Oh, so the best thing, the best advice that you gave, I think, is, you know, you turn the burner off and put a pot lid on top of the burner, or a cookie sheet or whatever.
Yes.
And that
will
help. And then get out.
Get out.
Get out of Dodge.
Yes.
After that. All right.
Get out and stay out is what
we're saying. Get out and stay out. So how long have you been with the State Fire Marshal's office, Amy?
Coming up on 7 years.
7 years. Mm-hmm. Now, what did you do prior to that?
So what I did prior to that, I kind of had two tracks, right? So it's going to be a little bit of a long reply, and I apologize.
It's all right.
So when I graduated college, I had a sociology degree. Not very marketable unless you want to go into academia, and I did not. So I got a job actually working with a community program with a government who was working on risk reduction programs for substance abuse.
Okay.
This is a long, long time ago.
Yeah.
And helping adolescents make better choices. And that kind of led to some training and some program things. And then fast forward, I worked for so sociology is really the study of people and groups of people, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So I worked for about 15 years with a little market research firm in Londonderry, and we looked at data and did studies for companies and such. So that's where kind of my data piece came, that nerd factor came in.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of had these two parallel tracks where it was kind of program and training and education, and then this side of like studying and data and numbers.
Yeah.
And eventually I was looking for something where I could do both. And I don't know how the heck I came here. fire service wasn't really on my first top.
Wasn't on the list, right? But you did, and I bet you're
later.
Glad you did.
I love it.
Is there any, you know, anywhere people can reach out if they want more information? Is there a hotline at the fire marshal's office?
A website would be great.
A website.
It's nh.gov/fire marshal.
Simple as that. nh.gov/fire marshal. That's easy enough. Amy McLaughlin, you've been a delight. Thanks very much. We appreciate all the outstanding tips. Don't throw water on that grease fire, folks. And cover it with a cookie sheet. Really.
Thank you so much, Ken. We really appreciate it.
And keep those grills 10 feet away from the home. All right, Amy, thanks so much. Amy McLaughlin, the Community Risk Reduction Specialist and a Public Information Officer from the State Fire Marshal's Office, part of the Department of Safety here in the state of New Hampshire. And that'll do it for this edition of Kale and Company. Remember, folks, to always look on the bright side of life. And have a great Tuesday, everyone.